You're listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks, your source for centered and focused play therapy coaching.
Hi, I'm Dr. Brenna Hicks, the kid counselor. This is the Play Therapy Podcast, where you get a masterclass in child-centered play therapy and practical support and application for your work with children and their families. In today's episode, I am answering listener questions, and I'm answering my first call-in question. So really excited about that. And there are still some email questions that I'm trying to work through. So a little bit less lightning of a lightning round. We're only going to do four today, but I'm still trying to get caught up. So thank you for your patience and thank you for all the questions. And Jess, thank you for calling into the call-in number. So if you all are in the States and you'd like to leave a question on the voicemail, you can call 813-812-5525 and I will play your question on air and then I'll be able to answer it. So the first one that came in was from Jess in Maryland. And so I will let you all listen to her question and then I will share my thoughts.
Hi, Dr. Brenna Hicks. My name is Jess. I'm from Maryland and I currently do child-centered play therapy with kids with autism. And I guess I've run into some issues with parents as they're trying to also navigate EBA. And there seems to be a stigma with the child-centered community towards ABA, and there seems to be a stigma with ABA therapists towards child-centered play therapy. And I guess I just wanted to hear how do you work with that stigma and I guess that hostility to make sure that you can really work with ABA therapists. So thank you.
All right. So thank you so much. Really interesting question. And this is a tricky, sticky subject because you are right. I think you identified accurately. There is, well, you used the words hostility and stigma, and I think those apply. But I think more even so than that, I think there is a huge theoretical disconnect. And so typically, you know, never the twain shall meet. And I think it's difficult to understand ABA from their perspective. I think it's hard for them to understand CCPT. And so I think it's just theoretically so different that there's really not a whole lot of carryover and crossover. But I will share some thoughts. So I have amassed over the years, actually another clinician at my center helped me to compile this, but I've amassed a pretty extensive resource library of ABA articles. So specifically from journals and certain publications talking about ABA and the fact that it is the most widely prescribed approach, but there isn't as much empirical support for it as the prescriptions. And I've shared these articles and these resources with every parent that has ever brought up ABA to me. And so I am not trying to disparage ABA, and I'm not trying to say that it shouldn't be used. Although I think that what should be used across all industries and all fields and in all scenarios is what is proven to be the most effective. And based on the literature that I've read, ABA is not effective. And in many cases, it's actually been found to be harmful. So many of the articles are parents that have reported their experiences while their children were in ABA. And then also ABA has been around long enough now, there have been articles that have adults who went through ABA as a child and their experiences. And there's a lot of trauma and sadness and anger and confusion and difficulty surrounding the ABA process and what it was like for the children, for the parents, for the families. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I'm not trying to be critical of it. I'm just saying the research does not support the fact that it is the most widely prescribed approach. And not only is it not necessarily effective, but it can be pretty harmful based on a lot of the research that I've seen. So that said, I think, Jess, to answer the first part of your question, I send parents all of those articles and I say, I would like you to read these over and I would like for you to decide for yourself whether you think this is the right approach for you and your family. Because again, it's about equipping and educating and helping parents feel that they have enough knowledge to make an informed decision. And many of them are told ABA and they follow blindly. And they really have no idea what they're getting into. And they really are caught off guard by the intensity of it. And I think that the more we can help them understand what to expect, the better. So I always have any parent who is actively in ABA or is considering it, look at all of those articles. I email them to them. All right. So now that I've kind of shared my opinions on that, if you happen to start working with a family that has their child in ABA or is exploring ABA, it's very important that you share and communicate with the family that they are completely different theoretical models. ABA is very directive. It is very praise-based. It is very performance-based. And so it is the polar opposite of the child-centered play therapy approach. And a parent needs to understand that for something to be effective, there has to be complete buy-in and complete adherence. That's why we talk about adherence to child-centered all the time. So for a child to be in ABA with directive, scripted, performance-based approach, and then to come to play therapy and be told, you're in charge and you get to choose to do whatever you'd like in here, it's overwhelming. So I think parents need to understand that they sort of, in my opinion, need to make a choice. And then my second thought is ABA as a program is so overwhelming and so intense. It's often 40 hours a week. It's in home every day, hours at a time. It is monumentally exhausting for the parents, for siblings, for the child involved, for the ABA provider. It's an overwhelming approach. It's like all hands on deck, all in, all the time. And, you know, 40 hours a week up to, it's so much to handle. So when we're thinking about therapy, therapy is also taxing. And therapy is only an hour a week, I understand that. But it is emotionally, mentally, psychologically taxing for a child. So we have to be sensitive to the fact that they probably can't do both at the same time, nor should they be expected to. Which circles me back to they kind of have to choose. So not only is it that they need to choose what theoretical model they feel is a better fit for their family, but they also need to choose which one they'd like to tackle first, because I have never found success with child-centered play therapy while a child is also in ABA. And in fact, I've actually seen the opposite happen. Things get worse because the child is completely confused and completely exhausted, and it's just too much. So I usually advocate that we only change one thing at a time when therapy begins. And that's universally across the board. That's what we talk about. You know, we try to minimize change so that we can determine causality. And we don't want a child to start soccer and play therapy and chess club and ABA. It's just there's too much that goes on. And then we're not really sure what is creating what kind of change. So we typically advocate that the parents need to do ABA and then pursue play therapy afterwards, or do play therapy, and then if they still feel the need to, then pursue ABA. And then finally, because the child-centered approach is designed to be implemented at home, if we coach parents how to reflect feelings, how to set limits, how to provide choices, there's continuity between what's happening in the playroom and what's happening at home. And obviously parental involvement and investment matters. So we are ideally, as we're working with a child, equipping parents with child-centered principles to use at home. ABA is doing the same thing. ABA is an in-home program, so the facilitator is working with parents and coaching parents how to respond according to the ABA tenets and philosophies. Parents can't be doing both. So it's not only conflicting theoretical models, it's conflicting parenting strategies. And a child can't be confused about what the expectations are. A parent can't be confused about what the expectations are. A parent can't respond in ABA fashion 1 minute and in child-centered fashion the next. A child can't be expected to know that they have full freedom to make choices in child-centered, but then they have no freedom to make choices in ABA. It's just, again, never the twain shall meet. So Jess, thank you for calling in and talking about this. And you actually said, you know, how do we make this not mission impossible for the child? Well, unfortunately, the child caught in an ABA-CCPT mashup will really be the casualty and the fallout of that. And so I think it falls on us to help the parent navigate that effectively and help the parent to decide which approach they feel is going to be the best fit and which one they should do first. I've had many parents bring up ABA when they sought therapy with me, and I've encouraged them to read the articles, talk to me, make their decision. They pursue child-centered play therapy. They do not pursue ABA. And I've only ever had one family after play therapy still seek ABA. So I think that that's a testament to the effectiveness of CCPT and that there are ways for parents to use the skills at home effectively. And obviously, look, when we're working with kids on the spectrum, this is a little bit of a related aside, but when we're working with kids on the spectrum, the severity matters, right? So, you know, high functioning is going to be very different than nonverbal low functioning. And for nonverbal low functioning kids, CCPT needs to be part of the solution, not the entirety of the solution. So obviously every family needs to make the choice for that specific case and situation. But child-centered play therapy is effective and it works and it equips parents with appropriate skills and tools to use so that they're able to better manage things that happen at the house and in their lives. So Jess, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate it. I hope that that is helpful. And I hope that for all of us, you know, almost always we end up having a conversation about ABA doing this job. So hopefully that will equip you with some knowledge of how to better have those conversations. Okay, so let's move into some of the email questions now. As I said, we're only going to do four today, so not as long, hopefully. Depends on how long one did I get. All right, so Courtney from Mississippi emailed a while back and said, I was curious on your opinion about TheraPlay and other attachment-based play therapy modalities with kids and caregivers. My current clinical supervisor has been highly recommending that I take a TheraPlay course or a filial therapy course, although I have taken one in the child-centered model. All right, Courtney, thank you so much. So let me share my thoughts on that. I think you 100% should take a filial therapy course. And I highly recommend the Child-Parent Relationship Therapy by Landreth and Bratton. That is really the most effective grounding for child-centered play therapy, and it completely aligns with everything that you know and have learned about the non-directive child-centered approach. So I would be in full support and favor of you taking a filial therapy course. Actually, speaking of, I'm going to be doing a filial CEU 3-hour CEU training with Corwell in March. So end of next month, there will be a filial course through Corwell and you'll be able to register for that soon. Not that I'm plugging that. I'm just letting you know there are lots of different filial therapy approaches, but if you want it to be very aligned with the child-centered model, the child-parent relationship therapy is going to be your best bet there. And here's why I advocate that you should be trained in filial therapy. Not only does it allow you to provide parent coaching as another suite of service for you, but you also are able to use the skills and principles to share with parents in consultations. So much of the process is trying to get parents to support the work that you're doing at home. And so if you have skills from a filial therapy model and you know how to communicate and articulate that to parents, that sets you up for greater success with your work with children in the playroom as well, because there's consistency across environments. Because if mom and dad are setting limits in the same way that you're setting limits in the playroom, that's only going to increase the positive outcomes for the child. So filial therapy, specifically the child-parent relationship therapy, I think would be a very, very helpful thing for you, Courtney, and for all of you, really. If you are not familiar with child-parent relationship therapy, it's amazing. It's really a foundational curriculum. That's how I train my therapist. That's how we train in the six-figure play therapy program. It's so powerful because it's comprehensive and it gives you everything you need, not only for your own clinical work, but for also communicating with parents and coaching and training them. As far as TheraPlay and other attachment-based models, I'm pretty familiar with TheraPlay and I understand the intent behind it. And when you have kids with trauma backgrounds and severe attachment kind of issues, I understand the value of the TheraPlay approach because it's very trauma and attachment based. Here are my thoughts. We at our center don't specifically work with a lot of trauma and attachment type of kids. So this is a little bit out of my scope. I'm just trying to be completely transparent, but here's what I know. The filial therapy program with CPRT, that's child-parent relationship therapy, for those of you that are not accustomed to that acronym. So we have CCPT, child-centered play therapy, and then we have CPRT, which is child-parent relationship therapy, which is the filial approach. CPRT is 100% centered around the relationship between the parent and the child, hence its name. But the entire approach is relationship-based, and inevitably, you create a healthier, more respectful, more trusting, more bonded, more communicative relationship when a parent and a child participate in the 10-week model. So I personally believe that attachment becomes very healthy through CPRT. And I also believe that when you have a child who feels that they have a very healthy relationship with an adult in their life, their attachment and trauma are able to heal. And so I'm not saying that TheraPlay doesn't have its place and its value. I'm just saying for the kids that we work with, CPRT has been extremely effective. And we've used this with kids in the foster care system. We've used this with kids that have been adopted. So we have kids and families that have gone through CPRT that have come from trauma and attachment backgrounds. And it has been highly effective. There's actually studies that show how effective CPRT is with fostered and adopted children. So I think that it's a really appropriate equal, if you will. And for you specifically with your supervisor recommending a filial therapy or a TheraPlay course, I would go in the direction of filial therapy because you know that will be completely aligned with the child-centered model. So Courtney from Mississippi, thank you so much for the email. I appreciate it. All right, let's go to the next one. And this one, we're going to call her E because she says for confidentiality, she would like her name not to be used. But I will call her E. And she wrote in from Brussels, Belgium. So thank you for listening all the way in Belgium. That's so exciting. So here is E's email, and then we'll dive into this. I have an 8-year-old client referred for confrontational and aggressive behavior with his parents. We have been making progress. He seems to be working out who he is in his play. But I learned today that he is still sleeping with his parents. He's an only child, and the roles and control in their family have become a bit mixed up. The parents have had some difficulties with their relationship, so it's like he wants to glue them all together. My instinct is that he will naturally not need to do this as he works toward his independent self in the playroom, but how can the parents best support this? We have agreed he needs more structure and firm boundaries at home to feel more secure. Should independent sleeping be part of this? And then she actually responded in a follow-up email and said, the child insists that they all go to sleep at the same time at least once a week to explain my comment about his need to glue them together. So E from Brussels, thank you for emailing in. So let me share some thoughts and unpack this a little bit. 100% what we're hearing in this kind of scenario is power and control. So let's tease this apart a little bit. So we have a child who feels that the relationship dynamic potentially, the marital issues potentially, the nature of the three of them as a family unit, he feels that he has not had control and power over things in his life. Obviously, when you have confrontational and aggressive behavior, that's also power and control. So everything ties back to a power and control issue. So he's grasping at any measure of power he can take. And in that scenario, then, the only way that he can feel that he has some control is to insist on things or refuse things, right? So we've talked in the past that, you know, kids only have control over a handful of things, and sleeping is one of those items. So when we're looking at this, I think, E, you're totally on target with some of your insight. So, you know, he's working on himself. He will naturally not need to do this as he continues to move on that. But how can parents best support this? Well, first of all, I think recognizing that it's a power and control issue, if we get to the why, it gives us a better track of how we'll handle it. So I think that's very powerful. Then we need to equip them with understanding of what's going on and effective tools. So I think it's noteworthy that he's an only child. You all know, well, maybe you don't. I think I've mentioned it, but probably not to the degree. You know how much I love birth order, and I use it ad nauseum, quite honestly, with parents and families with whom we work at the center. So understanding the role of an only child, they become parentified. And what that means is they spend all their time around adults and their parents. They talk all the time to their parents. They begin to think like their parents. And they put themselves on an equal plane as the parents, becoming parentified, meaning they want the same level of power and control and decision making. And they think they're capable of doing all of that, just like their mom and dad. So I think his only child parentification is also a factor in this, and mom and dad clearly need to be made aware of that dynamic and what's going on. And you alluded to it. You said, we agreed that he needs more structure and firm boundaries to feel more secure. 100%. An 8-year-old child cannot hold that kind of responsibility, should not hold that kind of responsibility, and can't be expected to. And it sounds as though he's putting himself in that position. It's self-imposed, right? But it's still not manageable and sustainable for him because he's an 8-year-old little boy that just needs to be able to be a little boy. So when he's trying to step in the shoes of being an adult and that parentification, that's very overwhelming, and the self-imposed pressure becomes a lot. So that is also a discussion that needs to be had with mom and dad. And then what can they be doing to support this at home? Limit setting, straight out of the child-centered model. So anytime there's a consistent pattern of behavior, we can set and structure the environment up for success. So it may be a deal where they put his mattress on the floor of their bedroom to start, but they set a limit that their bed is no longer for sleeping in. Or you can choose, and I'm jumping ahead to the T of the ACT and the limits, but I'll circle back to the whole thing. But you can choose to have us in your room until you fall asleep, or you can choose to sleep on the mattress on the floor in our bedroom. Which do you choose? And notice that the choices become the empowering piece of this, so that he still has a measure of control. However, there are boundaries being set. So the entire conversation would be, you really like us to all fall asleep together, or you like to be in our bed, or you feel safe when you sleep with us, or whatever validation needs to be mentioned to the child. And then the neutral limit. But your bed is for sleeping in at night, or our bed is not for sleeping in at night, or you are old enough to sleep by yourself, or whatever neutral limit needs to be conveyed. And then we move to the choices. And again, the choices are means to an end, because parents are setting parameters. Child is still given a measure of control. And then they both are working toward the end goal of he sleeps in his own bed by himself. So there may need to be some shifts to get there. In other words, it can't necessarily be cold turkey. Okay, from now on, you're not sleeping in our bed anymore. But if there are choices provided for getting him there, and over time the mattress is moved into the hallway and then the mattress is moved into his room or whatever, there needs to be progress made toward that independence. Now, you mentioned he will naturally be able to do this better as he continues his work in the playroom. Absolutely. So he'll have a better emotional vocabulary. He'll have better regulation. He'll have better coping. He'll have better resilience. So that in conjunction with the work that they're doing at home is, well, what is what will make this successful. So E from Brussels, Belgium, thank you so much. I hope that's helpful. And look, we all, and I say all universally because it's true, we all deal with kids that have sleeping issues. So I don't think that any of us can escape those conversations with parents, because that's something that on a daily or weekly basis, at least, we end up having to face when we're working with kids. So really helpful. Glad that you emailed. All right. And then B from Maryland. Hello to you Marylanders. What's going on? We had two Marylands this week, so... Marylanders, thank you for listening. I hope that you're staying warm. We're hitting like 80 this week, so not too wintry here. All right, so B from Maryland mentioned that she actually had a follow-up question to the Toy Takers podcast. So if you've been listening in order, hopefully you remember the Toy Takers podcast. And she said, I'm wondering when to keep to the if you can't say it in 10 words or less, don't say it rule, and when to ignore it. And so then she said the limit for taking toys sounded wordy to me. Is there a way to say it in less words? So really helpful follow-up, B. Thank you for sending that in. It's kind of a both and I don't mean to give a non-answer, but let me explain. So when we're discussing things with kids, when we're having conversations, when we're having an exchange back and forth conversationally, if you can't say it in 10 words or less, don't say it. That is just a universally helpful principle, because kids check out and tune out and they're not cognitive and they don't want to think. But there are times when you have to use a skill, and there are multiple steps to the skill, such as limit setting, where you cannot get away with less than 10 words. So often even just reflecting the feeling is going to take almost 10 words. Actually, I'll count it. You really wish you could take that home. Yeah, you're just by reflecting the feeling, you're at 8 words already. So it becomes tricky to remain in the spirit of brevity, but then also recognize that there are components that can't be ignored or left out. So as much as possible, try to be concise with your limits. Do not add extra words. Do not add extra explanations. But in certain skills, such as choice giving and limit setting, it does take longer to explain, and therefore you can't really get away with the 10 words or less. So I guess universally, as much as possible, if you can't say it in 10 words or less, don't say it. But there are times when it's going to be longer, and that's okay, as long as you try as much as possible to keep it brief and concise. All right. And then she had a second question, not related to that one. She said, I have a client who is extremely bossy and will ask me to get things for him all the time. I have this with other clients as well, but not as frequently. For example, he'll ask to bring the table closer to him, to bring him a tissue, to pick up a marker for him. I wasn't sure if there's a time when I should do those things for him, and what falls under the category of never do anything for a child that which he can do for himself. All right, so really interesting, and I love bossy, demanding kids, so this is my jam. Here are, in my opinion, your strategies for addressing this. It's really important to get to the why of the child's behavior. In other words, as you're being told, bring that table to me, get me a tissue, pick up that marker and hand it to me. And in true child-centered fashion, we are the actor in a child's play. And if they are giving us cues that we're supposed to be doing things, then we are theoretically, I'm air quoting, we're theoretically to do what the child has asked us to do. However, this is where your clinical gut reaction and judgment call comes in. Okay, because the why matters, and that indicates how we're going to respond. So if this is a power and control scenario, and I'm reading this and I feel like this could be a power and control, it also could be a learned helplessness, and I'm not sure which one based on what you emailed. But if it's a power and control issue, I feel powerful. I feel that I love being in charge and you have to do what I say because I'm the boss. And so I'm going to take dictatorial power and control in this hour because I don't get to experience this anywhere else with anyone else. So as much as I can, I'm going to milk the system for all that it's worth. So you're just going to be at my beck and call and do everything that I tell you to do every single time I'm in the playroom. Okay. If it's that kind of power and control scenario, then you would comply with the requests while also enlarging the meaning for the child and tracking the child's behavior. So let's tease that apart a little bit. So you would say, you like it that you get to tell me what to do in here. And then you would get the marker if he told you to get the marker. Because in that scenario, the child is using you as a means to an end to have that authoritarian dictatorial power that they're not allowed to have anywhere else. And the pendulum swings all the way to the other side, right? We talk about that analogy a lot. So they feel powerless in every other aspect of their life. They take as much power as they possibly can get in the playroom. And then they eventually realize that they need to find balanced center, and it all sorts itself out. So in the meantime, though, they're going to be bossy and order you around. And if it's a power and control thing, you enlarge it, you track their behavior, you're telling me to get the marker, you like that you get to order me around when you're in here. And then you get the marker for them. Okay, however, is it a learned helplessness issue? So in that scenario, when the child says, I need the table moved over to me, can you get me a tissue? I need to blow my nose. Can you get that marker for me? And honestly, did you notice that my tone changed even when I'm reading through these? Because that's a huge cue, right? So when the kid's like, go get me the marker, that's very different than, can you get me the marker? So usually you have a pretty good sense of what's driving the behavior based on the tone and the vibe that the child's giving off. But is this a learned helplessness issue? That's when you fall back on never do for a child that which he can do for himself, and you return responsibility. You'd really like me to get the marker for you, but you know how to get the markers down. And you return responsibility, because if the child is just deferring to someone else because they don't feel capable, they don't believe they're capable, they don't act capable, they're so used to just sitting around and having someone else take over for them, there's all kinds of reasons learned helplessness emerges. And in those scenarios, we want to empower the child to believe in their own capacities. And obviously that's self-esteem driven as well. So the more we return responsibility and the more the child accomplishes what they thought they couldn't or wouldn't, then we use esteem building. You did it. You got it. You didn't need my help. And then all of a sudden their sense of self is growing. So if it's a learned helplessness issue, that's a very different reaction. And then we also have to look at their developmental capacities. So there are going to be times when a child literally cannot do something. So something is too heavy, something is too high, even with the stool that's in the playroom, something is too tricky to navigate, they don't have the dexterity, they don't have the mobility, they don't have the strength. There are going to be times when a child is telling you to do something and it truly is that they are not capable of doing so. So then in that scenario, it becomes a collaborative effort. You'd really like my help. I wonder how you want me to help you. And then the child is cueing you how to do it, what to do. And then it's a work that you do together. And then you're able to acknowledge that the child solved the problem when the task is accomplished. So B, thank you so much for the question. I hope that that helps you, because obviously we do want to keep in mind, never do anything for a child that which he can do for himself. But the root cause and the why behind the behavior is definitely relevant in scenarios like this. And that largely indicates what our response is going to be. All right, y'all. So thank you for the emails. I'm getting closer to being caught up. I still have quite a few, though. I promise I'm going to get them through them as much as I can. As a random thought, my husband keeps telling me that we may end up needing to go to a call-in show where I just take calls live. And we're nowhere near that, so don't get super excited. But I'm just letting you know that we're at least talking about that. So in the meantime, you can call and leave a voicemail. But there may be a point in time where you can call and actually talk and it'll be live. So I don't know. We'll see. There's so many things going on. Speaking of so many things going on, The Collective has launched, y'all. So if you have not had a chance to check it out yet, please go to ccptcollective.com and you can get a free 14-day trial to check it out, see what it's like, and get in the community and interact with other participants and be on the live Zoom call with me and just really kind of get a sense of what it is. There's been so much activity. So many of you have already signed up since Tuesday's podcast when I announced it. So I'm so happy to see some of you hopping on. And it's so cool because we get to look to see on the world's map where people are when they're on the site. And you get little blue circles for all the people that are active on the site. And we literally had blue dots all over the whole globe. And it was so exciting. So we've had people from New Zealand and Australia and Europe and Canada and the States. So fun. And what an amazing thing to have a community of child-centered play therapists come together and just really live and breathe out this model. This is so exciting. So really looking forward to it. By the way, every Friday is our collective Zoom call. So if you join today or tomorrow morning, this is Thursday. So if you join today or tomorrow morning, you'll be able to hop on to the weekly call and we'll be live and I'll be doing some training and answering some questions and things like that. So ccptcollective.com, please check it out. It's been so fun to see everything developing there. So I'm really grateful for each and every one of you. Thank you for spending time with me each week. Please email me if you'd like, brenna@thekidcounselor.com. Again, 813-812-5525 if you want to call in, and ccptcollective.com if you want to check out the community. Love y'all. Talk again soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks. For more episodes and resources, please go to www.playtherapypodcast.com. Thank you.